It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Childhood obesity is a problem in Wisconsin that carries on into adulthood. The State Health Department figures show 68% of Wisconsin adults are affected by excess weight. The Assembly Speaker's Task Force on Childhood Obesity put forth 5 bills. Call in with the question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Republican Representative Karen Hurd of Fall Creek chairs the task force. Representative Hurd, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be on the show.
Well, before we talk about the proposed legislation, let's discuss your background. As a nutritionist, you say it's sobering to learn about Wisconsin childhood obesity. How bad is the problem here?
In the state of Wisconsin, even our little children, 2 to 5 years old, we have 10% of those children are obese. And from 6 to 11 years old, 15% are obese. And then we have 18% ages 12 to 17 that are obese. And these are figures that are supplied by the Wisconsin Department of Health Service that are current figures in our state. So, and then by the time we get to be 65, there's 47% of our population is overweight.
As a nutritionist, what perspective have you brought to these numbers and have you brought to the task force?
Well, I've been practicing nutrition for 30 years, and obesity is one of the underlying factors that create all other health, not all other, but many other health problems, such as diabetes, arthritis. We saw during COVID that those that were obese were more likely to have severe reactions to the COVID pandemic, the virus, than any other people that, you know, it was one of the underlying health conditions that made it worse.
So your task force in the fall goes out and talks to people. You went all around the state with public hearings. What did you learn?
We learned that there are many excellent childhood obesity programs that already exist in Wisconsin. They are few. I mean, if your listeners will know, I haven't heard of any childhood obesity program. They're few, and we need to increase their numbers. We need to expand those programs. We need to scale them up. We need to encourage new programs to happen. And all of these programs are happening, I call them siloed. They're not under one umbrella where the state is helping any particular program to be successful in addressing this program. So what these bills do is to have a statewide effort to find those programs that are working and doing well, encourage new programs to start so that we can significantly impact this problem.
So you feel that there is a need for more central coordination and management of these types of programs across so that they can reach a broader scope of our state?
That's one way of putting it. It's more of encouraging it to happen because right now there is no centralized, hey, let's work on childhood obesity and, you know, encourage the YMCA, encourage the school nutrition programs, encourage programs like Wood County that has going on. Let's encourage that program to go on. Let's encourage all, we have several different health systems. We have Gunderson, we have lots of them that are working to help, but none of them are particularly encouraged. They're sort of out there all by themselves on an island trying to help this problem. And so it's more of an encouragement and then a central management, because the encouragement is going to come in form of grants to, you know, give you money to help this program. I'm just thinking of the Family Resource Centers. What an outstanding program they have with the Triple P program that they administer. And then in that Triple P, that's a positive parenting program, that they address the obesity problem with children, and then, of course, it addresses the whole family. What an outstanding program if we could just encourage that to happen.
We're talking with Representative Karen Hurd, who chairs the Assembly Speaker's Task Force on Childhood Obesity, as we look at recently proposed legislation aiming to reduce childhood obesity in Wisconsin. You can join in with questions. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Representative Hurd, you mentioned the grant, $5 million grant program to support existing efforts to address childhood obesity. Why do you think these grants are needed?
Because of the severe obesity problem, and throughout these hearings that we held throughout the state of Wisconsin, there were two major concerns that kept coming up from every single agency. We spoke to many of them. One is that they spend so much time writing grants that there has to be almost a full-time person. That's all they do every day, is to write a grant. And then when they start a program with a grant that they won, that the program goes away, because the grant then, it's whether it's a one-year grant or two-year grant or however many years it was, then the money goes away, and then they're uncertain if they can get that grant renewed. So they always have to be spending time. So this grant program addresses that. And then the other problem is that there isn't enough money out there. There aren't enough grants to write for. There isn't enough support. And so what's unique, I see it as unique in this particular grant program, is that as in all grants, there's a match that's required. So there's a 25% match. But oftentimes with state grants, that you will, the match that you're required to have is from another grant, from a federal grant, for instance, or from a county grant. And so this particular grant program is requiring the match to be from a non-governmental unit, so from the private industry, because the state government, it is not Daddy Warbucks. We don't have these, you know, deep pockets of money that we can just always be funding everything, every good project. And there's so many good projects that have to be funded. Where the deep pockets are, where the money is in our country, is in the private industry, is in the private sector, whether it's a company or it's individuals. And so this grant says that you have to have 25% private funding. If you get 25% private funding, the grants are for 2 years, then in 2 years, given that the state legislator has renewed the funding for the program, and hopefully we will, but, you know, you never can tell, it's because that's still, you know, up, out in the future. But then you're automatically, if you have 25% private funding, your grant is automatically renewed. So you don't have to worry, oh, I wonder if we're going to get the childhood obesity grant from the state of Wisconsin again this year. If you had your 25% private funding, you automatically get the grant. And what's really unique about this program is if you increase your private funding match so that, say, you got 50% of the amount of the private funding, then we will, the DHS is going to be administering the grant.
Department of Health Services.
Yes, Department of Health Services. Then they will increase the amount of money that you're getting because you've done such a good job garnering private funds. And so then you can say, well, then they're getting more money. Yeah, what would that more money do, you know, because they garnered more public or private funds? It's so they can expand their program, go start this very successful program in the next town over or the next neighborhood over or the next place in Wisconsin. We want to expand these programs so the ones that are successful continue to grow. And so that's another thing to have your grant renewed. You have to show, hey, it was successful. You know, we had kids that actually lost weight and we reached a lot of people or whatever it is. It just has to show some success here. So.
And it sounds like, yeah, it sounds like you're trying to also provide that stability and that scalability in order for these programs to succeed.
Yes, ma'am.
Republican Representative Karen Hurd chairs the Assembly Speaker's Task Force on Childhood Obesity. The bipartisan group includes seven other Assembly lawmakers. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts on childhood obesity, 800-642-1234. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A group of Assembly lawmakers seeks to reduce childhood obesity in Wisconsin and puts forth a package of bills. The task force held public hearings last fall in Madison, Milwaukee, Eau Claire, and Wisconsin Rapids. Call in with a question. You can share your views, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Representative Karen Hurd of Fall Creek is chair of the Assembly Speaker's Task Force on Childhood Obesity. One bill your task force proposed would create this statewide nutrition incentive program for people who receive food assistance. How would this program work?
This is, we're calling it the Double Bucks program. So those people that have the SNAP, it's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. We used to call it food stamps. But those people who have SNAP, they can go to a farmer's market or actually any vendor that sells fruits and vegetables. And if they spend $10 on buying fruits and vegetables, they will automatically get $10 more to buy more fruits and vegetables. And so that is that program. And it is using funds that we actually already appropriated in 2017 that was passed in Act 266, which allocated $425,000 for a pilot program that was very similar to this. We have this happening. Double Bucks is happening in Dane County, in Milwaukee County, and then also in Eau Claire. We have some of this happening, but it's all privately funded, and which is, I think, a great thing. But we would like to see this happen throughout the state, just not in three, you know, localities. We'd like to be able to make this available to those on the SNAP program to be able to buy more fruits and vegetables.
It makes me wonder, though, what if you live in an area that is a food desert, and how would a program like this, you know, impact people who just aren't near the fresh produce?
Yeah, well, it would, almost everybody can even go to a Quick Trip would qualify too, as long as they're buying fruits and vegetables, because they sell fruits and vegetables. I mean, they have potatoes, they have everything. I'm sure you've been in it, and their Quick Trips are everywhere in the state of Wisconsin, even in the smallest little rural place. We're all close to one of those type of stores.
So states like Michigan and Ohio offer statewide double dollar nutrition incentive programs. And looking at last year, Michigan provided $2 million for its Double Up Food Bucks program. As you mentioned, the task force's bill would reallocate $425,000 in existing funding from the state health department. Is this proposed funding adequate?
Well, no, it wouldn't be, but it is a start to see, can we, because what we're doing is we have to find the people to administer it. It has to be a program put in place. If it goes well and we're succeeding in it, then that's what we look at in the next budget. Can we give more money to this program?
Let's take a call now. Jim in River Falls is with us. Jim, hi.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having this program. I'm glad the Wisconsin legislature is looking at this really important issue, because, it certainly is an epidemic, obesity, and the diseases that go along with the high blood pressure and diabetes are an epidemic in this country. And if you look back, you know, when I was a kid 40, 50 years ago, it wasn't as much of a problem. And part of that is, I believe, is the promotion of products like soft drinks. I mean, we need to really start taxing soft drink companies and reducing their influence on they're sold, you know, in high schools and in schools, and the school system really needs to look at, you know, promoting better food programs. The Farm Bill is going to be reenacted, I believe, this year, and that really, in the past anyway, has promoted things like corn subsidies for farmers and wheat and soybeans. And it doesn't provide money for farmers that are producing healthy produce and things like that. So, I mean, our food system would go a long way also to reducing healthcare costs in this country, which is a huge deal.
Jim, thank you for the call. Representative Hurd, Jim, bringing up how to deter soft drinks and you know, certainly also trying to find better food programs in schools.
Yes. Well, first of all, you should know that the schools have taken out soft drinks, you know, from schools, so now they have milk in their machines, water, you know, healthier drinks. But yes, we looked at different legislation about limiting what we would call unhealthy foods, but that gets into who determines if it's unhealthy or not. I mean, we basically know, and most people do know, this is not a good thing for me to eat. And this is something that we found out throughout all of our hearings, that the people of Wisconsin, the parents know, the people know, like Jim just mentioned from River Falls, people know what are bad foods, generally what they shouldn't eat. Even children know, oh, I shouldn't eat a bunch of sugary stuff. This is not good for me. But people choose to do that anyway. I mean, people choose to smoke cigarettes, and they know that it's not good for their health. So what we really have to get at is, how do we motivate people to make good choices, to buy the fruits and vegetables, to not eat the sugary, drink the sugary drinks? And that comes through, we're back to that grant program again, and then also to the Double Bucks program, is to encourage programs that are saying, hey, we will help you in making better choices. We will help you in doing exercise programs or whatever is necessary to get you to a place where that you can conquer the obesity problem that you have in your life or in your child's life.
And the testimony you heard in different parts of the state, it was what was happening in these programs that really stood out to you as making an impact?
Yes, exactly. It's, you know, you can say, well, we're trying to educate people on what are better foods to eat. That's already happening. And we all know that already. It's this, how do we get, you know, to the place where we say, nah, I'm not going to eat that. Or yes, I'm going to go and work out or have a place to go and swim or work out. So these are these programs that are really emphasizing this.
We're talking about recently proposed legislation aims to reduce childhood obesity in Wisconsin with Representative Karen Hurd, who chairs the Assembly Speaker's Task Force on Childhood Obesity. Call in with questions. You can add your thoughts at 800-642-1234. One proposed bill requires public schools, independent charter schools, private schools participating in a parental choice program to offer at least 3 hours of physical activity each week to students from kindergarten through eighth grade. State law already requiring physical education instruction 3 times a week for students in kindergarten through sixth grade. Why is this bill necessary?
It's because I substitute teach. Substitute teach in the Fall Creek school system, and it is true in all of our school systems that physical education doesn't necessarily mean physical movement, that we're actually, you know, we might teach tennis or we might teach something about physical education, but we're not actually in motion. And so this bill is requiring an activity where you're actually moving the body, not just sitting learning about how to play tennis, but playing tennis instead.
Okay, and so how would you ensure that that curriculum is updated, that if there is, you know, instruction on how to do something before it's being done, you know, I mean, how do you ensure that that is taking place?
Because the movement doesn't have to be, you know, during phi ed class. It just is making sure that each of those children have the opportunity. Recess would count, because when recess, they run out on the playground and they're moving. If they're involved in a sport, you know, that would count. Any type of movement, making available, you know, after school, you can stay and we're going to play softball or whatever. That all counts.
Your colleague in the Assembly, Representative Peter Schmidt, told the Shawnee Leader that a previous task force on obesity in the late 2000s failed to produce any bills from their work. How much support have you received from your colleagues on this task force's legislation?
We're receiving a lot of support. This is very well received. So we're hopeful that all of these bills will pass both houses. They'll be signed into law. That is our goal. We really want to help this problem in our state.
Does the bipartisan nature, do you think that impacts it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So this is all bipartisan effort. And so that helps, because we have a Republican legislator and then we have a Democratic governor. And so it helps to do everything bipartisan. And actually, most of the bills that we pass in the legislature, over 80%, I'd say even 90% of our bills. I mean, we were just on the floor last week. The vast majority of the bills, they're all bipartisan in nature. We really work together. You know, often you hear, you know, that, oh, they're at odds again, and we're always at odds. Actually, we do a huge amount of work, and the vast majority is all bipartisan.
So you think that there is interesting that there is a bit of a perception, a lack of perception that there is much more much more working across the aisle than we might not, you know, we may not be aware of.
Yes, ma'am. That's absolutely true. We do most things bipartisan. So So it's a good thing.
Representative Karen Hurd, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Republican Representative Karen Hurd chairs the Assembly Speaker's Task Force on Childhood Obesity. She's from Fall Creek, and was elected to the Assembly in 2022. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A pair of bills that would open up federal funding to expand Wisconsin's electric vehicle charging stations. It gains momentum in the legislature. The legislation would make it easier for businesses to operate EV charging stations. Call in with a question. You can share thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Emma Hines is policy manager for the Electrification Coalition. That's a national nonprofit promoting policies on EV growth. Emma, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on.
So we have an eye on this legislation that the state Senate has passed that would allow private businesses to run an electric vehicle charging station without following public utility regulations. What does this bill mean for Wisconsin?
Exactly. This bill is a really exciting thing for Wisconsinites and all of our EV drivers, because it allows people who are not public utilities to be able to charge by the kilowatt hour, or essentially the amount of power that you're getting. Whereas right now, you have to charge by the amount of time that you're at a charging station. So where this comes into play is basically standardizing across vehicles, across chargers, how much you're paying for that fuel, whether you have a brand new Tesla or maybe an older Nissan Leaf because you got on the train early, you'd be paying the same amount for charging in a public station. So the example I like to use for this is kind of against the way we charge for gas. So imagine if you pulled up to a Quick Trip or something, when you swipe your card, a timer started, and then when you pull out the nozzle, your nozzle was the size of a drinking straw. It would take you much longer to fill up for the same amount of gas that you've always gotten, for a factor out of your control, really. So this really standardizes and makes sure that everyone can pay the same amount, just like the way we do for gas.
Why should charging stations in Wisconsin operate separately, though, from public utility regulations?
So the public utility regulations really just means that they're allowed to charge by the kilowatt hour. Traditionally, okay, they're the only ones that have been able to charge by the amount of power. But this would just allow people to charge for that amount of time, or sorry, that amount of power instead of time. So it's making sure that whether or not you have an old EV, a new EV, you can kind of pay the same amount. We've seen cases where, you know, someone can pull up to a Tesla fast charger and maybe charge for 15 minutes, get a much lower rate. But if you are, you know, driving up north to Marinette or something, the only charger on your route is going to be maybe a slower level two charger. Or if you have an older vehicle, you'd be stuck at that charger paying for a much longer amount of time, even though you're going to be getting that same amount of power.
Yes, because explain a little bit more there. There's level one, level two, and level three charging relating to how fast it takes to charge.
That's correct. Yes. So a level one charger is going to be just the standard outlet you have in your home. We've seen people who will run extension cords, you know, out of their backyard or out of their garage and charge their vehicle. It's much slower, but there's essentially no impact on kind of the electrical grid or anything like that. A level two, that was going to be a 240 volt outlet. So that's like a washer dryer outlet or a fridge or something like that. Really easy to be able to put into your home if you have a newer build. It might not take any upgrades. Excuse me. But then, you know, you can work with your utility to put in that faster charger so you can charge in maybe 4 or 5 hours. If you're driving really long distances every single day, it might be a good option for you to know, okay, I can charge in 4 hours overnight, get, you know, a great utility rate for it, and then be fully charged in the morning. And then a level three charger is going to be what we call a direct current fast charger. These we only ever see in public situations. And that's kind of the Tesla supercharger style charger where you can pull up at empty, you know, charge for 25 minutes, half an hour, and then leave with a full charge. So that's what we're trying to prioritize on highways and what the NEVI program, so that's the National EV Infrastructure Program, which this legislation is also really important for, because you have to be able to charge by the kilowatt hour in order to receive these funds. And we will talk much more about that later, mm-hmm. I'm sure. And so, you know, you'd be able to pull up really quickly, charge, and get back on the road if you're doing a longer road trip.
So it's these level three chargers. When building a network, you would want to put among, you know, alongside these, like you mentioned, highways or where you have a lot of through traffic.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
We want to be able to get people in and out of these charging stations where they want to go, and then also give them a really standard price regardless of their vehicle.
You know, how would EV charging stations then be regulated under legislation like this if public utilities are not in the mix?
So it doesn't change a whole lot about their regulation. You would still be going through your normal, you know, local electrical permitting requirements. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. you'd still be filing that at the municipal level and going through all of those pieces. Right now, the only thing that would change would be that there's a 3 cent per kilowatt hour excise tax that's being added on through this legislation. And that's really just designed to capture revenue from out-of-state drivers, similarly to how we do with the gas tax. And so that you'd have to notify the Department of Revenue at the state level that you were putting in this charging station. And then that would serve as your permit to be able to collect and submit that tax.
Emma Hines with us, policy manager for the Electrification Coalition, as we discuss bills that would strengthen EV infrastructure in Wisconsin. Call in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. You mentioned the 3 cent tax per kilowatt hour for charging EVs at a private business. Is this EV state tax similar to what other states are doing?
We're seeing kind of a state-by-state rollout. Lots of different states kind of have annual fees or an excise tax, but we're definitely not the only one that are choosing this excise tax option. Georgia, Iowa, Kentucky, Montana, Oklahoma, and Utah all have kilowatt-hour taxes, and they sit right around the 3 cent mark where we are. Some, I think, go down to 2.6 cents up to 3.5 cents, but we're kind of sitting right in the middle.
How does Wisconsin compare to other states in its charging capabilities and its network now, where we stand now?
So compared to the Midwest, we sit pretty smack dab in the middle, honestly. We're definitely trailing behind states like Illinois and Minnesota, but are pretty level with Iowa, to the best of my knowledge. So we definitely have room to grow, but something I like to share is there's kind of a chicken and an egg problem with EVs and EV charging in the public network, because it's kind of a leap for businesses to say, okay, look at this. Let's take rural northern Wisconsin, for example. You know, they could be looking at putting in an EV charging station, but if they're looking around and doing their due diligence, they might say, well, there's not a whole lot of EVs up here, so I don't know that it's a great idea to put in a public charger. But then people living in northern Wisconsin might say, well, I haven't seen any public charging around here, so I don't feel very confident that I could get where I need to go or drive to Green Bay for a Packer game or something like that. So I am just not ready yet. I don't want to buy an EV. So it's difficult to kind of jumpstart the train. And so that's why we're looking at this National EV Infrastructure Program as a huge leg up in the public charging game, because it's really going to be able to allow people to get where they need to go. And it kind of de-risks the initial investment for charging providers. They only pay about 20% of that initial cost of those chargers to be able to participate in this network.
Do you think the national EV infrastructure, the program will put an end to that range anxiety, that fear that you won't have the adequate charging stations to ensure that you can safely do your trip?
It will really, really significantly help. Obviously, it doesn't cover every single highway across the whole United States, but it does cover most of the major interstate systems. And so it'll be putting in charging every 50 miles within a mile of the highway. So definitely much closer than where people have been able to access it now. You might be seeing folks, you know, having to switch highways, go 10 miles off route to kind of find maybe a level two charger at a hotel or something like that if they're looking to get up north now. So this is really going to build out the infrastructure. And also it'll serve as a demand signal for other companies who maybe aren't applying for the NEVI funds, but are still wanting to put in charging in Wisconsin, they'll be able to say, oh, there was, you know, an EVgo station here. It has really high utilization rates. This is a good market move for us.
Let's bring on a call. Eric in Prairie du Chien. Eric, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. What would you like to bring up?
Hi, I wanted to ask about parallel efforts to putting in these chargers. I work in 3M in Prairie du Chien, and the grid appears to be maxed out there in the summer months. We're often asked by the utility company to shut down lines in order to support the air conditioning in town. Are there any parallel efforts to expand power generation to improve the robustness of the grid in order to support the new charging stations?
Oh, that's really interesting, Eric. Thank you for bringing that. Emma?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I would say we do a lot of work with utilities across the country, and they're definitely aware of this problem. And I think, you know, there's a broader concern about making sure there's grid readiness. You know, we see blackouts or brownouts in the summer months, things like that. So they're definitely already working to make sure that they can, you know, maintain that demand. I would say a really important piece of this puzzle is going to be when you're charging. Right now, about 80% of your charging gets done at home. And so a lot of utilities are working to implement what we call time of use rates. And so it's basically giving a discount or an advantageous rate to people who charge in the middle of the night. We talk about peak power hours as being, you know, 6 to 9 a.m. or 5 to 8 p.m. That's when everyone is coming home, using their hair dryers in the morning, you know, starting to cook dinner. And so that's when we start to feel a lot of stress on the grid. But at night, you know, from 2 to 4 a.m. or say, or something like that, there's not that many people using the grid. So that's really the best time to charge your EV and when you'd see the least stress about it. So also, we're looking at still an incremental adoption rate. And so not everyone is going to go out and buy a Ford F-150 tomorrow, partially because Ford can't produce that many vehicles, but also partially because not everyone is ready to make that jump yet. No one is going to be, you know, throwing away their perfectly good car to purchase a new one. And so, you know, they're looking at this in an incremental space and just being able to keep up with the current demand.
Eric, are you looking at this issue as an EV owner?
I am not. I consider using one. I like the idea. It's in Southwest Wisconsin. It's a bit difficult because it's a little bit more rural here. I think there's a place for the market on electrical vehicles, but I think putting in the charging stations could be seen as putting the cart ahead of the horse if the grid can't support it. That's my concern.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for bringing that. Emma Hines is with us, policy manager for the Electrification Coalition. That's a national organization focused on policies to expand the use of electric vehicles. Call in with a question. You can share your insights at 800-642-1234. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A pair of bills moving through the legislature could help build out an electric vehicle charging station network in Wisconsin while unlocking millions of dollars in federal funds. We get analysis from the Electrification Coalition. Emma Hines with us, policy manager. And you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Emma, the bill allows Wisconsin to secure about $78 million in federal funding to help build this electric vehicle charging infrastructure. How critical is the federal funding to completing a statewide EV network across Wisconsin?
It's absolutely essential. I mean, so many of our awesome state routes and tourist destinations and everything are in northern Wisconsin. And so right now, there's really just not adequate charging, and especially not adequate fast charging to be able to get up to those routes and to those destinations. So the NEVI funding will be really important for making sure people can get where they need to go conveniently.
Are there concerns? How long would it take to build charging stations? I mean, what is that timeline like?
That's a great question, actually. It kind of depends on the initial or on the individual manufacturer and who's going to be putting in those charging stations. Right now, the request for proposals to DOT, which is who you would apply with to be able to get the money, that proposal is open. It just opened at the beginning of the year and it closes in mid-April. And so sometime, hopefully this summer, we'll be able to see kind of those awards. But the Electrification Coalition actually does some kind of great tracking about how long does it really take to see those funds go in. I believe it was early December in London, Ohio, we saw the first NEVI charger go in. And so we've started doing some tracking and measuring as more of them are going to be going in. How long does that actually take?
What economic opportunities could be expanded, in Wisconsin with an EV network that is more substantial?
This is a great point and something I think a lot of folks don't think about as they're talking about EV charging. So when you stop to get gas, you know, you might spend 5 minutes there, use the bathroom if you need to, maybe grab a cup of coffee, but you're mostly focused on getting back on the road. With EV charging at these fast stations, if you're going to be spending 25 to 30 minutes there, you might be stopping to go grab lunch. Or if you are in, you know, one of our awesome small towns, taking a walk down Main Street, grabbing some ice cream in the summer. So there really is a significant local business incentive for this. You're going to be spending some more time in that area. And so folks are going to be likely to spend a little more money and stimulate those local economies. And then also there's a benefit from the workforce development side. So to install and maintain these chargers, it takes electricians and repair technicians and other valuable trade professions. So there is going to be an increase in demand for those clean, stable, well-paying jobs all throughout the state, which is really exciting.
We spoke with Secretary Craig Thompson of the Department of Transportation in November, and here's Thompson talking about the department's federal proposal to install EV charging stations along Wisconsin highways.
As part of the plan that we had approved, we had to identify spots along those corridors no more than every 50 miles and no more than 1 mile off an exit where these could go in, that there would be the capacity and all that. So we've identified 62 locations.
So where is the State Transportation Department planning to install EV charging stations?
Where are they not? It's a better question. I will give, you know, my kudos to the Department of Transportation and their planning of this process. Initially, you know, they expanded their alternative fuel corridors, which is where these stations are going to be. And so they really are encompassing kind of where people drive. We had a much more limited map at the beginning of this process than we do now, which is really exciting. So, you know, right now, or once these stations are going to be implemented, you'll be able to get all the way up 141. You'll be able to take 41 or 43 to get to Green Bay, go to Packer Gains, and then all the way, you know, up 53 to get to Superior. So you'll be able to get pretty much anywhere in the state that you need to go, which is really exciting.
And along that route, I mean, you have to say that gas stations, they're everywhere. They're ubiquitous. Are some gas stations making overhauls to their infrastructure to add EV charging stations?
Definitely. I think that's a really exciting piece of this, is kind of looking to transition some gas stations, not completely to electric, but kind of add to their service model what they're going to be offering. I know Quick Trip was at both the Assembly and the Senate hearings for these bills, and they were talking about how excited they were to put in electric charging. These businesses really want to just continue to improve their customer experience, and ultimately, you know, Quick Trip could stand to benefit if I stop and buy more than just a quick coffee or use the bathroom when I'm charging there. So definitely gas stations are interested in this market. And we've seen this happen before. I mean, compressed natural gas, 30 years ago, it would have been unheard of to put those in gas stations, but there was a consumer demand for it. And so gas stations kind of met that demand. And I definitely think we're going to see the same thing with electric.
I wonder then, will there be a competitive marketplace or competitive pricing to sell electricity at gas stations? I mean, do they look at the long game here as this is something that we can market and provide?
That's a really great question. I think, you know, we're pretty early in the market to see just exactly how that'll play out in Wisconsin. But a piece of that is going to be utility districts. And so depending on if you're in We Energies versus Madison Gas and Electric or a co-op up north, they all do have slightly different utility rates. And so I think we'll see some price reflection from the energy that they're purchasing from the utility and then how they're able to sell it.
were talking about recently passed Senate bills that would strengthen electric vehicle infrastructure in Wisconsin. Emma Hines with us, policy manager for the Electrification Coalition. You can join in with questions. You can share what's on your mind at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Last week, our show asked listeners for program suggestions. We heard from Vern, who asked whether electric vehicles are practical for Wisconsin, considering our state's latest temperatures have hit well below zero. What can you tell us?
Oh, I was waiting for this question. I definitely, I won't disagree that cold affects battery range, but I guess I can provide a little bit of, nuance to the conversation. I will also kind of say, ICE vehicles, which are internal combustion engines, the traditional gas cars that we drive, they also have a decreased range in the cold, which I don't think that most people, think about. It's kind of factored into our internal calculus of when we need to stop and get gas and things. The Department of Energy says that EVs can lose around 30% of range in extreme cold, and that can depend on the kind of vehicle you drive, the kind of battery, et cetera. But also in the same report, it shows that ICE vehicles can lose up to 15% of their range in the cold. So yes, it is more, but definitely not unheard of ranges. And also, this drastically changes kind of with the EV that you buy. This made a much bigger difference when, the first and second generation EVs, their range was 80 miles. 30% of that could start to affect, a long commute or something, whether or not you're able to make it home and back. Right now, if you're buying an EV off the lot, a range would be 250 to 300 miles. And so we don't really think about it as much because we have such a longer range.
Okay. Well, in our less than a minute we have together, what policies does the coalition want our state legislature to take on next?
Absolutely. We're really excited to see this policy moving forward and hopefully clear the assembly in the next coming weeks. But after that, we're still going to continue to focus on expanding the public charging network, especially in rural areas. We have a business coalition that we work with. So making sure, folks not just in Madison and Milwaukee are going to be able to have access to charging. I also do a lot of just general education. I hate to say the phrase culture wars, but that's kind of what's going on with EVs in the media, it feels like. So a lot of my job is making sure that the right people have the best information. One of the awesome parts of my job and working in this industry is nothing is the same week to week. But if you don't do this full time like I do, it can be difficult to stay up to date with kind of the most new information. We're also looking at using the Volkswagen settlement money for transit buses and electric school buses. So looking at that public transit side, like I mentioned earlier, with utilities and finding, advantageous rates for EV chargers overnight, it's definitely a huge priority for us. And then also looking at consumer finance incentives. EVs have gotten much cheaper in the last year. They've gone down in price about 20%, but the sticker shock can still be very real for folks. So we want to make sure that low-income drivers especially would be able to access these clean, affordable vehicles. So we're definitely looking into consumer finance incentives.
Emma, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was such a pleasure.
Emma Hines is policy manager for the Electrification Coalition. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In an election year where Wisconsin is once again expected to be among a handful of battleground states, Vice President Kamala Harris is visiting Wisconsin today to launch a nationwide tour advocating for reproductive rights. On Friday, ahead of her visit, I spoke with the vice president about the Biden administration's response to limits on abortion after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned decades-old protections in 2022. We first asked why the vice president chose to launch her tour in Wisconsin, of all places.
Well, first of all, I have spent time in Wisconsin, and maybe fun fact, I once lived in Wisconsin when I was a toddler, and so I feel a sense of connection to Wisconsin. But, Wisconsin in many ways is ground zero for this issue. And so I'm coming to speak with the good people there about the fact that we stand with the women of America with the people of America and fighting for fundamental freedoms, including the freedom to make decisions about your own body. And the tour in general is to send a clear message that President Biden and I, we trust women to know what's in their best interest, and that the government shouldn't be telling them what to do when they have the ability and facility to know what they need to do and what's right for them.
Abortions were banned in Wisconsin after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the nationwide protections. And now abortions are allowed again in the wake of lawsuits challenging bans under state law. What reproductive rights are you advocating for in Wisconsin?
Well, ultimately and essentially that we restore the protections of Roe v. Wade. And so I'm coming to Wisconsin on the 51st anniversary of the decision in Roe v. Wade, which acknowledged and recognized the right of women to reproductive freedom, which means having the ability to make these decisions for themselves and not have restrictions by the government such that they don't have free will and freedom in that regard. And I'll say on this issue, I think it's important that we all agree, and I believe we do, that one does not have to abandon their faith or deeply held beliefs to agree that the government should not be telling her what to do. You know, if she chooses, she will consult with her priest, her rabbi, her pastor, her imam, but it should not be the government telling her what to do.
You've been talking about this issue all over the country, but what is your administration doing to support people who are denied access to abortion services in their states?
Well, there's a lot of work we've been doing, but ultimately the work that we are doing to also encourage folks to understand the power of their vote on this issue is going to be quite decisive in terms of the outcome of it all. The work we have been doing as an administration includes protecting the right that everyone has to emergency care and ensuring that the law as it relates to the right to have emergency care, which means that one should not be and cannot be denied emergency care, that we are reminding hospitals and healthcare providers of that requirement. We are also making sure that people have access to contraception. Many may remember that when the Dobbs decision came down, it included articulating that contraception might actually be on the chopping block. Excuse me, I guess that's not the right best way to say it, but might be at risk in terms of people having access to contraception. And so we are fighting to ensure that all people have that access. And ultimately, also ensuring that people have the right to travel and are not denied that ability. I say that because some laws, of course, and some states have proposed that leaving the state to receive health care and reproductive health care could result in some form of penalty.
To that extent, would you support the federal government covering the travel costs of people who must travel to other states for abortion services?
Well, right now we are focusing mostly on what we have in terms of the current laws to protect these rights, and that has been our area of focus. But I will tell you that I certainly do discuss a lot and highlight that there is a real economic impact to these laws being passed, especially as it relates to working women, to people who don't have paid family leave, who don't have savings that will allow them to actually be able to afford a plane or train or bus ticket to go where they can receive the reproductive health that they need. And then we also have on the issue of travel policies that support, for example, travel for military members of the military, because as you probably know, those service members don't have a choice in terms of often where they are deployed and which state they then go to. But invariably, they may end up in a state that has banned abortion services or restricted those rights. And we don't want to penalize the men and women who have signed up to serve because they happen to go to a state with these draconian laws.
Here in Wisconsin, Republicans in the legislature are proposing a ban on abortions after 14 weeks unless the mother is at risk of some injuries or dying. What is your response to that limit?
We have got to put back in the protections of Roe v. Wade. And that's what President Biden and I are determined to do. President Biden has been very clear when Congress passes a bill restoring the protections of Roe v. Wade, he will sign it into law. And frankly, these are some of the biggest issues at play right now, including what is significant about the outcome of the election in November.
You know, a recent Marquette University Law School poll estimates about one third of Wisconsin residents think the economy is not so good. Why focus on reproductive rights during this national tour rather than other challenges facing our country?
Oh, we have to do both. And I think it's very important to not it is important to understand the connections between them all. When we talk about fundamental freedoms, the freedom to have access to the ballot, the freedom to make a decision about who will be your elected leaders, and how they will choose to take positions that either support your need to raise your family or not. These issues are connected. Fundamental freedom to make decisions about your body are connected with economic policies and how we think about issues like affordable child care, how we think about issues like paid family leave. And ultimately, we have to be able to do both, which is fight for freedom and also strengthen the economy. And on that point, then, which is the point about the economy, we have done an incredible amount of work. We still have more to do, but we have record low unemployment. On the everyday cost of life for the American family and Americans, we have accomplished it's very significant work, such as capping the cost of insulin for our seniors at $35 a month. Sadly, too many of our seniors have had to make the choice of whether they can afford to fill their prescription or fill their refrigerator. Similarly, we are finally allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices for seniors so that seniors will not pay more than $2,000 a year for their prescription medication. Student loan debt has been an area of focus for us. Far too many working people are just burdened by debt, which they are finding understandably very difficult to sustain while they want to raise a family. And we have, as of now, relieved over 3.5 million Americans of their student loan debt, including those who have taken on a life of public service. So this work will continue. And thankfully, we have seen that, you know, as a recovery from the pandemic, under our policies, the United States has actually recovered faster than any so-called developed nation in the world. And there is more work to do, but good work has happened.
Vice President Harris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, and I look forward to being in Wisconsin. Thank you.
That, again, was Vice President Kamala Harris. We spoke Friday ahead of her event in Wisconsin Today that launches a nationwide tour on reproductive rights. For more news coverage from WPR on the Vice President's visit to the state, check out WPR.org. And for a deeper dive on the history of abortion policy in Wisconsin, you can check out the podcast from WPR Reports, How We Got Here, Abortion in Wisconsin Since 1849. And you can find the podcast on your favorite podcasting service or at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Millions of people take part in a health challenge, abstaining from alcohol during dry January, as it's become known. And increasingly, it's becoming a year-round phenomenon, according to Fast Company, as consumer interest in alcohol alternatives soars. We get the view from Wisconsin and hear you. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sam Green is head brewer for Untitled Art, which is based in Wanakee and distributes non-alcoholic beer and other beverages nationwide. Sam, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, hello. Thanks for having me.
Yes, Untitled Art is considered a leader in the emerging non-alcoholic craft beer scene, if you will, but the company started out making seltzers. What led you to start making non-alcoholic beer?
Yeah, so we started, I think, about 6 years ago. We did do a couple beers, bringing new styles to Wisconsin to have a better representation for kind of what was going on in the world, and shining light and bringing Wisconsin up to par with kind of these new age styles. And we wanted to pursue seltzers and we wanted to pursue non-alcoholics. I think kind of after COVID, people had a lot of self-reflection and they kind of said, well, this is a really dark time in my life. I need to kind of think about my health, my mental health, my physical health. And non-alcoholics were a nice kind of alternative to that. So we wanted to make some healthy beverages.
But non-alcoholic beer has had kind of a bad reputation. Why did initial brews traditionally taste so bad?
Yeah. So initially, past couple decades, it's only been this arrested fermentation. So for those familiar with brewing, you'll kind of brew a regular full-strength beer and then halt the yeast immediately, kind of disrupting the natural life cycle of it. And that leads to what brewers call wordy, which is just kind of a unfinished, unrefined, super sweet kind of beverage. And the whole beauty in beer is this balance between bitterness and sweet. And once you kind of knock this sweet level too high and reduce the bitterness, you have an unbalanced beverage. And that's where kind of these non-alcoholics weren't getting it done. So this new technology is reverse osmosis and membrane filtration, where you can just kind of really, really finely concentrate the liquid, withhold all the flavor, subtract the alcohol, and then you can rehydrate it back up. And those have been very promising.
Is that the approach you're taking at Untitled Art through reverse osmosis?
Yeah, so we have gone in two directions. There's three. One is vacuum distillation, which we don't do. That's how you make a 0.0% alcohol. But you can do this arrested fermentation or this membrane filtration. And we, for different styles, do different creations. You know, some of the beers are going to express themselves better in one way, and some can't be rehydrated back up another way. So
Is the water still a super important component of how you make the beverage?
Oh, yeah. I mean, especially in non-alcoholic, now that you're it's basically 99.5% water.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't start with a great tasting base, you're going to have trickle down effects. You know, the mineral content is off, or if it's too hard or too soft, you'll taste that in the final product, and the hops and everything react differently without alcohol being in there, kind of as a solvent or as a palate cleanser.
So where should people start? Which of your non-alcoholic beers would you recommend someone start with?
Well, it depends. We kind of, our Untitled Art way is we're pretty aggressive, I guess. We're not afraid to try these zany microbrew styles. So Italian Pilsner was a very popular one for us. It is basically our number one seller. We also have a non-alcoholic juicy IPA for those people who like IPAs.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal for us has always been, we wanted to make beer that's great tasting, not with this asterisk next to it. Yeah, it's pretty good for a non-alcoholic. we're trying to go up.
I think you've
against...
heard that before.
Yes. We're trying to eradicate that kind of mentality. So our secret fantasy is to kind of have you taste our NA Juicy IPA versus your local brewery's IPA and not be able to tell the difference between which has alcohol and which does not.
We're talking about the renaissance in non-alcoholic beers. Sam Green is head brewer at Untitled Art in Wanakee. You can join in. Questions and comments about NAs, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sam, how is the marketplace out there? What kind of market growth are you seeing in non-alcoholic beverages?
Yeah, so it is, for lack of being cliche, it's on fire right now. We made a large push a couple of years ago to pursue non-alcoholic just for personal interests, and that has paid dividends left and right. You can kind of see too, a lot of people are very attracted to this, and I don't know if that's a younger group of people who just kind of, what we wanted to do was prevent this ostracizing of, you go to a barbecue or a sporting event, and if you don't drink alcohol, especially in Wisconsin, you're kind of looked down upon. It's kind of, oh, what's up with this guy? So that's why we want to pursue the regular 12-ounce cans. You're cracking a beer with your friends, you're keeping pace, and it looks like you're drinking and you're able to participate in that. And that's played pretty well. And personally, I actually consume quite a bit of them as well, in replacement for soda or just any kind of carbonated beverage.
12-ounce cans, is non-alcoholic beer getting the shelf space at supermarkets or at liquor stores?
Yes and no. So you can kind of see how it is growing a little bit, but it's never going to be a replacement for the massive brewery's footprint that they have. But I mean, at first we kind of had to fight for it, especially on draft. We're on draft as well. And now people are approaching us asking, where can I get this? Where can I get this? And that's how economics will play out, is there's more demand. So now we're making more supply, and you see it more and more at different locations.
I was wondering, do NAs show up on tap in establishments?
We're one of, yeah, I don't know. Now it's recorded, but I believe we're one of the only people who does that, because you need a lot of infrastructure, and we're fortunate enough to use Octopi Brewing, and their beautiful state-of-the-art equipment to complete that. A lot of other breweries can't ensure non-alcoholic on draft.
So, Octopi Brewing recently purchased by a Japanese company, Asahi. What effect will that have on Untitled Art?
It should not affect us. We contract brew at Octopi. There's a few other locations that we lightly contract at. If anything, it might even tighten things up. I think there's a lot of extra funding that's due to come in. So all the micro, the lab, all that stuff is going to get even better. And I think Octopi was in the leading front of all that, but this will just kind of be a cherry on top. So.
So the craft scene is going, it seems, and the big name brewers are also getting in on this. And I'm just wondering, what impact does that have on competition and how this you approach this type of space?
That is a good question. So it's been interesting. So we were kind of, as was said, non-alcoholic beer wasn't very good. We wanted to make something that is great. And that got, we'd like to think, maybe it's not true, but that got the attention of a lot of big brands, Corona, Blue Moon, Sierra Nevada. You can see they're all coming out with their non-alcoholic versions as well. Is it a competitive space right now? I don't believe so. A lot of the brewing industry is pretty altruistic, a lot of camaraderie. Eventually, that'll kind of dwindle down and it will get a little competitive. But as for now, I mean, anyone who can shine light on NAs is going to be good for us, and what we're doing is good for them. So the more people that drink it, the kind of more open the market becomes.
Last question here in our final moments together. Nancy and Madison wants to know, what relationship does NA beer have with the batch beer that was produced during Prohibition?
Oh, that I don't know. I will personally look that up, though. So I
There,
like this question.
yes, there could be some historical perspective there as well. Well, Sam, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing the work you're doing.
Wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Sam Green is head brewer at Untitled Art. It's based in Wanakee, distributing non-alcoholic beer and other beverages around the country. Stay with us as we turn our attention to non-alcoholic cocktails in the view from a Milwaukee hybrid bar. Call in with a question you can share in the discussion, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Can non-alcoholic cocktails offer as much complexity and flavor as the full-proof spirits? Call in to explore that question. You can share your perspective. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We discuss the sober cocktail innovations underway in Wisconsin with Kat Doty, operating partner at Milwaukee's Agency. That's a hybrid bar that serves alcoholic and non-alcoholic versions of its mixed drinks. Kat, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So Agency opened a few weeks ago. Can you explain the concept behind it?
Yeah, so we just opened about 3 weeks ago, just in time for Dry January. And our goal is to really offer a completely equal experience between drinking and non-drinking. Our entire menu is completely split, available as alcoholic and non-alcoholic. Everything is the same, glassware, garnishes, all the table side. You're ordering from the same menu. So you really have a chance to feel the same kind of connectiveness as any other kind of cocktail bar.
How is it being received so far? What are initial impressions like?
It's been really amazing. And what's, I think, the coolest thing is we're seeing people who have been abstaining from alcohol for years that haven't really had a chance or a place to be able to go out and, you know, be with their friends who do choose to drink. And now we're seeing these people who are, you know, kind of getting back into it, and they're hanging out with their friends, and, you know, they have their non-alcoholic beverage and their friends are drinking the exact same thing, just with a little bit of booze. But then what's also been really interesting is we've found that a lot of people are just taking that agency to choose for themselves that, hey, I'm going to have two cocktails, but either, you know, I have to wake up in the morning, you have something busy, so then they'll switch to the next one or two of NA. So it's been really interesting and pretty wonderful to see just how people are really approaching this and really just kind of appreciating the ability to choose, like, yeah, I still want a really great cocktail. This time, no alcohol.
How difficult is it to make two versions of the same drink?
It's been a really fun experience. My background is very heavy into, like, I come from a kitchen background, but with my cocktails, I tend to lean pretty spirit forward. I tend to go a little bit boozy. So, you know, really diving into NA was a lot of fun. And there's a lot of challenges that come with it because you want to make sure that you're keeping all the flavors balanced and everything. But there's been times where we'll start with a cocktail and we'll make it into an NA, and we really fall in love with it, and it gets us to push our alcoholic concept a little bit more. So it's like, wow, this is fantastic. We can bump the other one up. And so it's kind of been this fun little dueling thing where they're kind of just bumping up each other until we end up with this really phenomenal product, both for non-alcoholic and alcoholic.
So in the end, do you want someone to not be able to tell that it's non-alcoholic, or is that not a real central goal?
We want everyone to feel incredibly included. Mm. You know, there are times where we'll be drinking one of our non-alcoholics and it's like, wow, I could have sworn that there was actually alcohol in there. Mm. But it's really very much similar to just being able to play with those flavors and being able to just give the same exact experience. There's only one cocktail that we make one slight little difference, and that's simply just the stencil in which we do a little bit of allspice on our amaretto sour. One of them has the symbol for alcohol, and one of them has a symbol for water, and that's the only difference between any of our cocktails.
Hmm. Kat Doty with us is operating partner at Milwaukee's Agency. It's a bar that serves both alcoholic and non-alcoholic drinks. And we're talking about the non-alcoholic ones and the challenges, the opportunities that Kat sees. You can join in with questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kat, I understand that you dislike the term mocktail. Why is that?
It's a term that we're not a big fan of at Agency. We feel that it kind of just literally brings a mockery to it. And what we're trying to really do, and what I think a lot of people in the NA industry are really trying to do, is show that you can still have the same experience. And we're still putting the same amount of care, consideration into all of these. And so it really truly is just a non-alcoholic cocktail, you know. And one of the things that our partner Ryan, he likes to talk about is, he's like, it just doesn't sound cool. You want to go out for a mocktail? Like, no, let's go out for a drink. Let's go out for a non-alcoholic.
Let's give
it the respect it deserves.
How do you feel about the term sober cocktail? Is that okay?
I haven't heard that before, but I'm a fan of that. I can do that one.
Okay, all right. Well, so are you selling more alcoholic or non-alcoholic drinks?
Right now, we're still leaning a little bit more alcohol. I mean, we are still in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. But I think that we're kind of around like a between 30 to 45%, depending on the days, between the non-alcoholic, which is really been exciting to see just how people are responding, and especially being in Milwaukee. And I think this really goes for Wisconsin as a whole. We're known as having a really strong drinking culture, but I think with that comes a really strong sober community, and they're coming out and they've been really enjoying it. And for anyone who's, you know, participated in Dry January or Dry-ish January, whatever you choose to do, they've been really showing up and appreciating it. And so I'm interested to see, you know, as we progress, if it does kind of change, if we do start getting a little bit more NA, or it's, you know, it's a fun little experiment. And this is so early in to this NA world, and it seems that it's all just taking off. So we're just going to see what happens.
well, Kat, I was thinking of you last night as I was eating my pizza in front of the TV, watching football and drinking Stout Premium Kitty cocktail. Have you had one? They're so good. Have you had the Stout Premium Kitty cocktail?
No, I haven't. Oh, where can you have, find one?
In the grocery store. They're like in the soda aisle. And it's, you know, I don't know. But kitty cocktails, what can you tell us about making them, and, you know, what makes them better?
What we really find is that it kind of just gives you a little bit more fun that you can play with. We always say, you know, NA spirits are not necessarily created to drink on their own. Mm-hmm. They're definitely meant to be combined and creating something really wonderful and magical. So it's, you again get to kind of have your own agency of what you want to do with that. If you want to make a really fun little syrup, or if you want to try it with a, you know, different topping of sodas, and be creative and have fun. And so it's, as much as it's wonderful that we have these, you know, canned products and other that are just ready to drink NA products, if you're feeling a little creative, play with some NA bottles. Make a fun little syrup. Don't take it too seriously. I always say, if it stinks, just chug it.
How do you address the sugar content issue, though, and you know, keep the calories down?
Yeah, so that is definitely something that we've been trying to really be very mindful of. Mm-hmm. Really what it comes down to in this, it really comes to just, again, balancing those flavors and playing with the acidity and being mindful of how these NA products are created. A lot of times it's taking, you know, you have all these different flavors that are essentially distilled separately, and then they all kind of combine them instead of doing it in one. So taking that, sorry, my cat is loving this, that kind of concept and just being a little bit mindful. And I've noticed that you can drop down a little bit of your sugar for most simples. Like if you normally you're going to go with a 0.75 ounce or even a full ounce into a alcoholic cocktail, generally with an NA, you can bump that down at least a quarter, if not a half ounce.
Okay, Kat Doty with us, operating partner at a hybrid bar in Milwaukee, serving alcoholic and non-alcoholic versions of its mixed drinks. And you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. You can add your take at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss the growth and the innovation in non-alcoholic drinks and get tips for making non-alcoholic cocktails at home. Kat Doty is operating partner at Milwaukee's Agency. That's a hybrid bar serving alcoholic and non-alcoholic versions of its mixed drinks. Call in with a question. You can share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kat, what are your favorite drinks that you've made non-alcoholic versions of? What have been your aha moments?
Oh, that's a tough one. It's been fun. We do a lot of collaborative effort over at Agency, but there's two that I think really stand out for me. One is our Aviation. Aviation has always been one of my most favorite cocktails. I feel like it's one of the cocktails that really gets a lot of people into being like, oh, wow, this is cool. And for our NA one, that was one that we were so excited about the NA, and it got us to bump up the alcohol. So that one, we actually make a fantastic violet candy syrup. And for me, that is just all nostalgia and such a core memory. That's something that my mom has always been chewing on. So pulls at my little heartstring a little bit. But then we also have a part of our menu, which is us having experimental cocktails and us just really pushing the limits of what kind of silly things that we can do. And one that I'm really excited about is our Jurassic cocktail. That one is, it's like just walking through a prehistoric rainforest. It's so much fun. It's a wild cacao washed mezcal or non-alcoholic mezcal, a little bit of rich jaggery syrup, which is an unrefined sugar, very commonly used in India, then a little bit of Moli bitters from our friends at All the Bitters, then a little roasted red pepper oil, and then at the end, we automize it with geosmin, which is the chemical compound that's responsible for the smell after rain. So you sip this room temp cocktail, and you're kind of just immersed in this, wow, there's a dinosaur next to me.
It feels like you really want to draw people in using all their senses in order to kind of transport them through the beverage.
Oh, absolutely. We try to make every aspect to be an experience. As soon as you walk into the space, you kind of just feel like you're in this cool little cocktail lounge kind of thing. And during the day, it's Discourse Coffee. And so we flipped this fun little cafe and, you know, change it. And we have so many different options at our table side. You know, the geosmin is spritzed at your table side. Another one of our experimentals, the New Frontier, we build a little mini parfait right at the table side with that too. So it's really just us trying to make every moment feel really special for, again, whether you're there to kind of get back after being away from bars as an NA drinker for years, and now you can come back and have this really cool, elevated service.
When you are thinking about ingredients, do you prioritize local ingredients or seasonal ingredients when you're creating these drinks?
Oh, absolutely. I've used quite a few different products from our friend Mushroom Mike. He is just wonderful. And I actually had an opportunity back when I was a cook, maybe did like 8 years ago. I worked at a wonderful farm to table restaurant, and we used a lot of Mushroom Mike products. And so it's been really fun kind of getting back in and being like, oh, I remember these. I remember this. And one of our lead bartender, Alana, she's just wonderful and fantastic. She's also a forager. So the last like week or so, we've all kind of just been getting really excited for spring to come and foraging and seeing what we can do with all these seasonal fun times.
I would imagine Wisconsin cranberries could potentially be in the mix for these drinks.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're probably all going to do like a Agency in the field and kind of go up to Door County and see what kind of wonderful things that we can find there.
But here we are in the throes of winter. What makes a good winter drink?
Ooh, playing with those root vegetables. I think a lot of times root vegetables don't get the love and attention that they deserve, especially in, you know, making cocktails and all that. I personally really love working with parsnips and salsafia, especially celery root. That one can be a lot of fun. So kind of just really taking those warm flavors and then adding, you know, the classic baking notes, the allspice, cinnamon, get a little brown sugar up in there and throw in some herbs and boom, you just made a delicious winter magicalness.
So when you're working with root vegetables, do you like boil them down or how do you extract the taste?
Yeah, there's a couple ways that you can do that. We do a lot of things with sous vide. So you can, for example, for like parsnips, I would probably roast those off, you know, throw in a little fun herbs while those are roasting, and then put them in a blender or a Vitamix, add equal weight of the root vegetable with sugar, blend that all down, and then throw it in a little Ziploc bag, you know, heavy duty guy, sous vide that overnight, strain it away, and that's delicious.
Kat Doty is the operating partner at Milwaukee's Agency, a bar that's serving alcoholic and non-alcoholic drinks. As we look at the future of NA drinks and cocktails, you can join in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Heard from Phil in Crystal Lake, Illinois, called in, and Phil's wondering, what is the difference in price between NA drinks and alcoholic beverages? Phil assumes that non-alcoholic drinks should be less expensive. Is that the case?
So actually what we're finding is there's a lot of the NA bottle offerings are actually going to be just as expensive, if not more expensive than say just, you know, a rail bottle of vodka. Because again, there's so much thought and care that goes into creating these. And there's a lot of science that goes behind, you know, behind the scenes. And so generally a bottle of an NA spirit can go anywhere from $22 to $35. So you do kind of have to take that into consideration. It's especially with what we do at Agency, we're using all of the same flavors, the same syrups, all that kind of stuff. We're just flopping out, changing a little bit of the ratios. So it does end up actually being about the same. There's been a couple times where after pricing it out, I find that the NA is actually slightly more expensive.
Can you explain how you mimic the feel of an alcoholic beverage without the alcohol?
Yeah, so there's a few different ways that you can do that. Utilizing different like gourmet syrups to really kind of get that mouth feel.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times too, it's sometimes you'll notice that the way that the burning kind of alcohol aspect, a lot of times in NAs are trying to recreate that sensation. And it's been really interesting to see how everyone kind of does it a different way. Sometimes you're going to use actual peppercorn, sometimes capsaicin. So you have to be aware of that and see how that really plays out. It's a lot of tasting that happens, a lot of tasting, a lot of tweaking.
All right. Well, tasting and tweaking, what advice do you have for folks who are trying to make these creations at home?
I say just have fun with it. You know, figure out what kind of flavors you like to play with. Do you like citrus? Do you like floral? Do you like something that's got a little bit of smoke in it? Playing with smokers is really fun to do, especially with NA. It just kind of holds on to it really well. But yeah, there's a lot of NA spirits that have a lot of recipes kind of ready for you. Check them out online and then tweak them at home, you know, add an extra dash of this.
Are you watching what's happening in the non-alcoholic beer space and the demands there? And how might that inform the future of non-alcoholic cocktails?
Yeah, I think what's, you know, there's non-alcoholic beers that have, you know, really been making a lot of big steps. But I think what's also really cool is seeing what's happening with NA seltzers. Wisconsin has System Seltzer that they, I think, actually got the first true patent for a non-alcoholic hard seltzer. And that's a big deal. Like, they got that before White Claw.
Hmm.
So you're seeing kind of like each of the branches really going crazy, even with non-alcoholic wine. A few years ago, you would try non-alcoholic wine, and it's that, you know, Welch's sparkling kind of thing that you had when you were 12 years old and it's New Year's Eve.
Yes, yes.
Now they're actually phenomenal. Like, and it's really wonderful to see how each of the different branches of the alcohol world are really kind of harnessing the non-alcoholic aspect and just stepping everything up. And I think as we see bigger players coming in, there was one that just Tanqueray just announced an NA. And when you get people like that, this is serious. This is real. This is happening. And the products are just going to keep getting better.
In our final seconds together, what is your biggest challenge in making a new non-alcoholic cocktail and how it is received by customers?
I think the biggest challenge is just we really don't know. We're one of the first to really do this, so we're kind of just putting it all out there. We're trying our really best, and we're hoping that people love it and appreciate it and keep coming back for more.
Well, Kat, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh my gosh, thank you so very much.
Kat Doty is operating partner at Agency. It's a hybrid bar serving alcoholic and non-alcoholic versions of its mixed drinks. And earlier, we talked with Sam Green, head brewer at Untitled Art, which is based in Wanakee. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.